Hello and welcome to Monocle 24's The Urbanist, the show all about the cities we live in. I'm Andrew Tuck. Coming up on today's programme.
With what we do at Islington Square, we're essentially responsible for the placemaking, is one of our kind of key objectives. So to kind of activate the public spaces.
We bring you a bundle of reports from the past couple of days. We're at the London Design Festival to hear more about the importance of placemaking and bringing neighbourhoods together. Then we explore the line between rural and urban in Montevideo, unpack how New York City changes when the UN rolls into town, and head to Abu Dhabi to hear about a new park changing the landscape for the better. That's all coming up in the next 30 minutes right here on The Urbanist with me, Andrew Tuck. So welcome to this week's episode. Today we're coming to you from Athens as we put the finishing touches to our annual Quality of Life conference, but more on that later. Let's get stuck in and turn to London, because the city is currently playing host to Design Week. The challenge with new brownfield developments in any city is enticing life and activity into their newly completed buildings and public spaces. In an effort to do this, Islington Square, a recently finished mixed-use neighbourhood in North London, has partnered with London Design Festival to launch a week-long showcase that's aptly titled Islington Design District. The event, which runs from the 18th to the 26th of September, includes a placemaking programme developed by Charlie Hay and his team at Campbell Hay Studio, who've worked with a host of designers, including LG Batten from The Art of Ping Pong, and Benjamin Bill and Charlie Haslam of Bench Studio. To find out more, Monocle's Nick Manise paid a visit on opening night.
I'm Charlie Hay. I'm the creative director at Campbell Hay. We're a multidisciplinary design studio, and we're working with one of our main clients, Islington Square, which is where we're standing today, within a placemaking and design remit.
Can you tell me a little bit about Islington Square? What is it for people that maybe aren't familiar with London or aren't familiar with the project?
Well, Islington Square is a project that's very close to our hearts. We've been working on it for a fair while now. It is a mixed-use development. There are apartments and homes. There is a fantastic cinema and gym complex. There's a lot of mixed-use retail, restaurants, and a kids club. So it's, you know, there's something for everyone. There's apart hotels as well, so people kind of visiting the area can stay, or friends and family can find a place to stay nearby people they're visiting Islington.
And I understand, just from us chatting briefly before we dived into this interview, that your background is as an industrial designer, a product designer. What role are you playing in, I guess, shaping this new community? How did you end up working here when, you know, I think for many people it's typically the domain of architects and landscape architects and planners?
I studied product design as a degree, so I was familiar with the design festivals. We've been around the world to, you know, the New York Design Week, Milan Design Week, and, you know, we'd seen the kind of crowd drawing capacity that those events have. And with what we do at Islington Square, we're essentially responsible for the placemaking, is one of our kind of key objectives, so to kind of activate the public spaces. And we thought that an interesting way to do that would be to get involved with LDF. We've been thinking about it for a couple of years, but the timing had never been quite right. Initially, we were looking at it in 2019. At that point, it was too early in the kind of the scheme's build cycle. And then, of course, we had the pandemic and COVID, so 2020 was a write-off. So we were keen to kind of make it happen in 2021.
And what does that look like? What does the placemaking throughout the London Design Festival look like?
The placemaking at Islington Square, it features a host of pop-ups, furniture makers, furniture designers, an initiative that we've been involved with The Art of Ping Pong, which is, you know, really fun, kind of a slightly more frivolous element to the show. A ceramicist called Naked Wear has got a brilliant kind of live exhibition happening. We've got Justine Green, who's curated a series of posters. That's in the bi-residency unit. One of our retailers, Arlo and Jacob, is hosting a workshopping mood boarding workshop, and you know, you can book that online. And we've also got Bench. They've set up a live studio where they'll be taking consultancies and kind of working with clients directly in the space to kind of work on commissions or design furniture.
And what's, I guess, the overall ambition of all of this, of, you know, the ping pong or inviting people into businesses that have tenancy here? What's the ambition?
The ambition, I think, is to establish Islington as a destination not just for retail but kind of culture and design more broadly, and to emphasize, I suppose, or to work with the, you know, some of the brands that we've got here. We've got Arlo and Jacob, which is a furniture brand. We've got other lifestyle brands as part of the permanent retail mix that kind of, I think, benefit from the halo that LDF creates. It's just generally raising awareness of the scheme and giving people a reason to come down and visit.
So my name is Algie. I run the Art of Ping Pong. My background is in graphic design, so I used to have a design agency called 5'6". Me and my business partner closed it about 5 or 6 years ago. Art of Ping Pong was a side project, really, one that I kept going. And in the last probably 2 or 3 years, it's gathered more momentum, and it's become now my main gig, really.
And what is Art of Ping Pong? Can you explain what the concept is?
I feel like it's one of them things you need to have your pitch, your elevator pitch worked out. But basically, it's having an interest in ping pong and a background in design. It's just kind of celebrating the more the subculture of ping pong, so more the sort of the urban games, less so the sort of the organised clubs, but celebrating ping pong through bringing art to it and a design focus. So we do products, we do artist collaborations, brand collaborations, we put on events, and where possible we try to bring in supporting good causes. So tonight we've got Fandango Kid live painting one of our mini art tables, and we'll auction that off for charity. So it's nice to be able to do stuff like that, but really it's me messing about with bringing an art and design background to the world of ping pong as much as anything else.
Can you talk maybe a little bit about the two permanent ping pong tables that you're going to leave behind here after the festival at Islington Square permanently? I mean, what's your hope for them, and how do you hope that might shape or change people's behaviour in this part of the city?
I guess some of the permanent tables seem to have a bit of a subculture around them, or a bit of a scene around them. There's some in Granary Square in King's Cross, and there was a guy who came along tonight who's part of that club, and I know there they have really good players, and it's become like a sort of informal but really high standard ping pong club in an open space. So I'd love it if that started to happen here, or started to happen in Canary Wharf, so that that kind of thing became more commonplace. So when after we played a lot of ping pong at work, a few of us thought we were kind of pretty good. It turns out we weren't that good. But we joined the ETTA, the English Table Tennis Association, and suddenly the scene there was quite formal. You had to play with regulation rubbers. It was quite sort of strict. And we were like, we're not real ping pong players here. So the scene that goes on in King's Cross, for me, is much more my sort of thing. It's a few people just get together on an evening. They play a lot. They start to get to know each other. They start to have tournaments. So if that same thing can now happen in Islington Square, I think it'd be fantastic.
I'm Ben, and I work with Charlie. And we started Bench about 2.5 years ago. And it's a design and make company, and we sell freestanding furniture and built-in cabinetry. And my background's in design and architecture, and Charlie...
My background's in making, so like we started working together about 2.5 years ago, and in the 7 years that Ben was training to be an architect, I was in a workshop gaining experience, and we've kind of like gone two different routes to get to kind of the same point, in a sense.
And what are we doing here, Charlie? What's tonight all about?
We're here, me and Ben are here, showing an exhibition of what our company do and showing our furniture collection that we've recently finished. It's been about 8 months since we've completed our first line of furniture, where the bread and butter of our company has been design and make projects. And this has been a really amazing opportunity to be able to showcase that to an audience of sorts. For me personally, because I never studied, this has been felt like a graduate show for me, which has been really nice. And in terms of what we want to kind of get from it, it's, I guess, exposure in a sense, and hopefully some good conversations will come out of it. And it feels like the end result will be slightly intangible, what we're going to really gain from this. But it's really nice to be in a space, to be part of the London Design Festival, and to kind of like put what we're doing on the map, essentially.
And then I guess in terms of just being in this area and this neighbourhood, being an almost a shop front setup for this week that you're here, do you think it's going to inform your designs in the future? Are you changing the way you're seeing people?
I literally moments ago had a conversation with this Icelandic couple and their ceramicists about meeting up with them and having a chat about maybe a collaboration. So in that respect, yeah, totally. It's again that thing of just being in a place to have a conversation that's just that far greater level than you could get over an email or a text message or a phone call.
There's been something really nice about how that we've essentially set up a shop unit that is acted as an office for us for the week, and it's really nice to have somewhere that's kind of like fully furnished in our freestanding furniture, and like to have a week of us working together in a really beautiful office is not something we often do, because we either work from home or work from a workshop.
I guess just finally, lessons for other cities that might be also hosting festivals. Is there some merit in inviting designers and other creatives to work in unexpected places throughout a city? And what do you think that can do for a city?
What's nice about it is the incidental conversations that you have with people you otherwise wouldn't. And I think that probably works both ways. So for us, in the last couple of days, chatting to people who just live locally and maybe don't have any interest in design, and for us to showcase the things that we do, has been rewarding.
Monocle's Nick Manise there, reporting from the opening night of the Islington Design District, which is on until the 26th of September. This is The Urbanist. Now, another city that has been busy hosting some of the world's most important people is the city of New York. Leaders of 193 countries have descended into the Big Apple for the United Nations General Assembly. But how different is world diplomacy after the pandemic? And how does a city which is still currently imposing coronavirus restrictions adapt to having the world's mighty roll into town? Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak, reports for The Urbanist.
Vaccination is helping in Queens, in all five boroughs, everywhere in the city, and we're using our vaccination capacity to reach the whole world this week because it's United Nations General Assembly week. Back in New York City.
There has always been an uneasy relationship between diplomats and the city of New York, but no more so than during the annual shindig that is the United Nations General Assembly. This week, New Yorkers welcomed world leaders back to their city for the first time since the start of the pandemic. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio, speaking at the top there, did his best to speak to that classic concern New Yorkers have whenever world leaders roll into town.
Of course, I want to urge all New Yorkers, avoid the area around the United Nations. On the east side of Manhattan, it's going to be congested for most of the week. But again, there's a lot of good things happening this week that we're happy.
But of course, this year was different, and not just because of the return of traffic. For one thing, the United Nations has to be much more diplomatic than New York when it comes to safety measures. The UN, for example, called for everyone to be vaccinated, but had little choice but to accept that some world leaders may not be vaccinated, and so went by a sort of honor system that basically amounted to a policy along the lines of don't ask, don't tell. Shh. If it had been up to New York Mayor de Blasio, any world leaders who were not vaccinated wouldn't have been allowed into the country at all.
We need to send a message to all the world leaders, including most notably Bolsonaro from Brazil, that if you intend to come here, you need to be vaccinated. If you don't want to be vaccinated, don't bother coming, because everyone should be safe together. That means everyone needs to be vaccinated.
The fact that de Blasio had to make such a statement during a briefing at a school in New York, unveiling the city's policies for how to get children back to school safely, smacked of those double standards that New Yorkers hate so much. Children and parents need to take precautions, while diplomats are perceived to run around the city with impunity. But while there may not be much the Big Apple or de Blasio can do at the national level, or at the UN Secretariat itself, that hasn't stopped New York from enforcing the rules elsewhere in the city.
We have a citywide policy called Key to NYC, and this requires you to show your vaccination card to be able to enjoy any sort of indoor entertainment.
This is Penny Abiwardina, New York's International Affairs Commissioner, basically the city's foreign minister.
This was the attitude that we also took in terms of working with the U.S. mission to the UN and the President of the General Assembly and the Secretariat to ensuring that vaccinations are at the heart of how people navigate not only UNGA, but how they navigate New York City while they're here.
New Yorkers, of course, are the ones that have to suffer the consequences if world leaders and their dignitaries are roaming their city without taking appropriate precautions. That reality has also led to local businesses and citizens rather hilariously leveling the playing field against people not used to having to follow the rules. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who has defiantly refused to take the vaccine, was most famously pictured outside on a New York sidewalk with a pizza after a local establishment apparently would not let him in without proof of vaccination. The whole episode does highlight a delicate balance a city like New York has to play more than most. New Yorkers tend to take pride in their international outlook, But with that reality also sometimes comes a lack of control. Penny Abiwardina insists that despite these complications, diplomats do generally play a positive role in the city. And she cites the earlier stages of the pandemic as an example.
The relationship that we've had with this corps during COVID, during the height of COVID, so going back to March 2020 when New York City was the epicenter here in the US, we received historic donations from the United Nations for PPE. We received donations, everything from PPE to ventilator parts to meals for our healthcare workers from our diplomatic corps. So we really rode the hardest part of the wave here in New York City with them together. So we very much feel like they're New Yorkers.
Abiwardina says that New York also returned the favor by offering vaccinations to all of the diplomatic corps that remained in the city throughout the pandemic. So while the arrival of world leaders may have caused problems for some New Yorkers this week, it's worth remembering not just the bad apples that come with that responsibility. The diplomatic corps that lives in the city, they have a stake in the health and safety of New York as well, and participating in what makes this city great. At the end of the day, as Penny says, they're all New Yorkers, really.
Thank you, Chris. That was Monocle's news editor, Chris Chermak. Next, we're off to Uruguay. City dwellers can easily forget the broader landscape that they're part of. In countries such as Uruguay that have a strong agricultural heritage, each year the countryside comes to town. In Montevideo, the capital, thousands gather each September at the Expo Prado for a moment that connects both worlds. Our Latin America affairs correspondent, Lucinda Elliott, sent us this story.
Well into its 150th year, the Grand Prado exhibition in Uruguay showcases livestock, farming equipment and produce cultivated in rural corners of the South American country, right in the heart of the city. For a week in September, it's not uncommon to see gauchos on horseback roaming the streets outside Parliament as they make their way to a series of events and present their best breeds in the capital, Montevideo. The main pavilion is open to all, with stands that promote the countryside. It's one of the big inner-city school outings of the year, with students able to pet baby lambs, learn about cultivation, and even get a taste of some of Uruguay's most sought-after homegrown exports. Some embassies, including Britain, use the expo as an opportunity to promote bilateral trade. This year, there was even live Scottish dancing. It's long been seen as a way to remind townies and the central government that the backcountry exists, helping to unite these two very different lifestyles that make up the same nation. President Lacalle Pou, himself a city dweller who was born in the capital, reiterated the importance of maintaining a dialogue with the ranching community that's not only important to Uruguay's economy, but also its cultural identity.
For several years, we come as a team to talk and better understand what's happening and to exchange ideas. It's a very important sector for Uruguay, and not just for what they bring to our economy, but how they live.
Bueno, estamos viendo un nuevo ingreso, los bretes 40, 41, 43.
Bueno, con un nivel de ejemplares realmente espectacular y destacado, con muchas expectativas ya de largar con la jura.
The expo this year coincides with a fiery debate over land rights. A protest organised by the rural community went ahead, as well as several other strikes to demand that they're better looked after and contest a reduction in public funding. Back in 1948, Uruguay enacted a colonisation law. Part of its transition to democracy, it meant that smaller dwellings were granted proper land rights and protections, in most cases, with families paying a reduced rental fee to the state that owns the land. A similar system is in place in former colonies like Australia, Argentina or New Zealand that rely heavily on their farming sectors and pastoral origins. But as more and more people move to cities, roughly 1.3 million of Uruguay's 3 million population lives in the capital alone, questions over how much funding should be designated to these remote areas and why their rent should be subsidised at all are being raised. and more so during the pandemic, when purses are particularly stretched. Roughly 400,000 hectares in Uruguay fall under the subsidy system, with fewer than 4,000 people actually tending to that land. The government, as one observer told me, has acres and acres that Uruguayans indirectly pay for, rents them out below market rate and all, so they can win the rural vote. It's an entirely outdated system, they argue. Estimates suggest that if those hectares were rented to the private sector, to commercial farms or foreign investors at current prices, Uruguay would stand to receive over $1 billion of annual income. Income that could go to help growing cities. For Monocle, in Montevideo, I'm Lucinda Elliott.
Thanks, Lucinda. This is The Urbanist. And finally, there's a brand new issue of Monocle magazine out on newsstands today. And you might notice a few differences. We've taken advantage of the summer to get a bit of inspiration and rethink our pages and features. One of the stories we cover is about the Al Fai Park in Abu Dhabi, a newly completed project by the Danish design firm SLA, offering 27,500 square metres of public space. That's roughly the size of about four football pitches. The best part, they do that without using planting and irrigation that becomes at odds with the surrounding desert environment. Rasmus Astrup is a partner at SLA and the man who led the project. He told us more about their vision behind it and how they've made it a reality.
SLA and myself has been traveling and working in UAE for 6-7 years. We always wanted to see if we could bring our DNA of city nature to a region that has no soil, region where it never rains, and to a region where the speed of the development is sometimes 10 times faster than what you see in Copenhagen, for instance. And it was based on our approach that we believe that every nation's culture is deeply linked to its nature. Especially the culture of UAE is people surviving in a harsh environment. But then you discover, and it's actually surprisingly rich. That was kind of our starting point, the inspiration and celebration of the UAE nature. And that was what led us to be luckily invited for a pitch for this park, which is called Al Fai Park. And Al Fai is literally meaning shadow. So of course, Al Fai is the purpose of shadow of the tree. And I think shadow of the tree is the key to many things in UAE. And this park in particular is about shadow of trees. So this park has an element of biodiversity, but also microclimate. Cities like Abu Dhabi, Dubai, all American new cities, they are copying each other. Globally, cities are just copying each other. It's a competition. Who's the fastest, biggest, most interesting? But there's no such thing as who's the most original, who's the most sustainable. There is, but it's starting to be seen now that cities are competing in other elements than just the tallest, the fastest. So that transition or paradigm shift is very interesting. And the fact that a park like Al Fai can happen in Abu Dhabi is, for me, of course, because locally in Abu Dhabi, they were ready to do that. They asked for that. So that's step one. But it's also globally. We are right now in the biggest crisis the world has seen ever. We believe so because of this pandemic. But we believe that the biodiversity crisis is way bigger. And the biodiversity crisis is the fundament for everything, right? That system, you can never get it back. So if you lose a species, it's just gone forever. And the cool thing about celebrating biodiversity, there is this link between culture and nature, but also microclimate that is a fundament that you need to solve in a city like UAE. So by merging all this sense of belonging, awareness, we can see that it's really a game changer.
And it's so brave that they did it in Abu Dhabi, because I haven't seen a new development this bold before. And then maybe it's weird to say when we are the designers, but it's the first park in UAE without a lawn. There's always a lawn. There's no lawn in this park. I think it's the first one where we radically from the beginning took an approach where biodiversity was a driver for the whole design. It's the first one where microclimate was really also driving, like how can we lower the temperature, which is of course important. And it's also the first one I've seen where you have this hardcore approach towards irrigation that is embedded here. And then of course, on top of that, it's all about getting in touch with nature. There's a forest track. Basically, it's an activity park. Then we said, well, if you want to have activities, the best frame for that is a forest, because it cools down the environment. It brings informality that is great for social engagement, for sports activities. And it brings identity. So it's kind of an urban forest that is also something new. It's really going in the right direction. I think they have pushed so many boundaries. It's challenging, of course. For a landscape architect like us, it's important to say that every city can contribute to biodiversity. And that means that you need to come in with a complete different approach. You need to bring biologists and very special expertise. For instance, in Abu Dhabi, there's no soil. So what do we do? Then we had to make a new soil texture. We had to irrigate in a special system according to water and topography. We had to do a new maintenance. Biodiversity is about different species, but it's also about animals. So after, I think, 1 week, there was 2 beehives and 3 bird nests in the park, because the animals love it as well. So they moved it as habitats. And it was a big debate because people were a little afraid of the beehives, even though they're like fundamental, you know, to have the ecosystem working. And the bird nets are annoying because, you know, they get noisy and messy. So we are now debating, how can we find a balance of such an element here? Because everybody should be allowed to be there. It's not just a park for human beings. It's a park for all living creatures. I think it does a lot for the local community because it's bringing informality. Open spaces or public spaces are kind of the most democratic places that I would like to be voted for in cities. And when you have a park like Al Fayh, even though you can play sports and such, there's no program. You're not forced to buy anything like you are in a mall. So everybody can be there. I kind of love to go there and see the diversity there, because it's kids, it's elderly, it's all ages, it's all backgrounds. So there's really a diversity, and they are active together. They play sports, they run around, you know, so it's not formal, it's informal. And I think that whole concept of people sweating, playing basketball, walking around, running, playing, is a super cool way to engage and socialize and bring people together.
Rasmus Astrup, a partner at SLA, and you can read the full story in the October issue of Monocle magazine, which is out today in all good newsstands. And that's all for this edition of The Urbanist. Join us next week as we bring you some highlights from our Quality of Life conference, which is happening in Athens this weekend. Maybe that's why my recording is sounding a little bit different today. We're in a rather large and a little bit echoey room. But today's episode was produced by Carlotta Ribello and David Stevens. And David also edited the show with assistance from Steph Chungu and Jack Jewers. And playing out of this week's episode, here's Richard Hawley with Tonight, the Streets Are Ours. Thank you for listening, City Lovers.
Do you know why you got feelings in your heart? Don't let fear of feeling fool you. What you see said